you by Satanic International Network. You're listening to The Ooze.
Upon the stage, every foul wicked spirit in the host, The Ooze.
20 minutes, Zadar Ove, on The Ooze, spread out.
On The Ooze, it's gonna fucking rock. Be there.
The whole point.
To really happen to have a serial time
necessitates a certain fortitude.
Now on to our show.
All right, it's Sunday night. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you're listening to the Ooze Outbreak Edition with your hosts, T.C. Downey and Jason Sorrell. And T.C., what's going on tonight, man?
Oh, man, not a ton, dude. Just got off of work, maybe an hour ago. Just got done with the commute home and popped in and said, oh, shit, that's right. I've got to do the show tonight. So here I am. I got to apologize to people because over the past month or so, it may seem like I just have not done my homework. Or maybe I'm mentally tired or something, and that's the case. I mean, this time of the year for me is, I can only describe it as being like trying to organize full-blown wars in three different continents.
Right on, man. I think a lot of people that know you, too, understand that that's kind of what's going on. But I haven't noticed, man. I haven't noticed you slacking off at all, so not a big deal as far as my end's concerned. I've been keeping busy. The tattoo gig's been keeping me busy here. I've been doing some commissioned artwork and actually managed to squeeze in a piece for myself here recently. I didn't know if you had a chance to check that out yet or not. I did the Julie Zombie Girl from Return of the Living Dead 3 as a pencil drawing.
Right, yeah, I did. I saw that. I actually saw it, you posted it on your Facebook wall first from what I saw, and then later announced it on the website. Thought it was fabulous, man, and probably one of the, it's going to go down in history as a Sorrell classic, man. I mean, that's got to be one of your best pieces. I mean, there's an amazing amount of symbolism, imagination, a dead zombie worship, just very cool piece, man.
Right on, thanks, man. Well, it's been something that's been sitting on my drawing table and everything else for a while now, and I've been kind of picking at it because I don't have time to really sit down and do something like that all at once, especially with my list of shit that I need to get into that I'm actually getting paid for. So, but it was kind of cool finally to get around to getting it finished and knocking that out. It's just kind of a way to take a break from all the commissioned work that's kind of dry. I've got a cool tattoo design that I'm actually getting paid for on Monday, and then I'm still working on this other guy's tattoo, and this thing is going to be like my opus, I think. It's going to be full of symbolism. It's going to be a back piece, and it's really coming together. I got an idea and drew something up already, and it was cool, but now we're going to try to take it up a couple notches and then knock this out and have this be an actual tattoo by the end of July or early August or what have you, if the guy's still available. So, but things have been going cool, man. The other thing that's going on right now is all my kids are here. One of my daughters is up north in Indiana most of the school year, and she's only here for the summer. So it's kind of cool to have all the kids here and just playing around, being the dad, having a good time. So that's been fun as well. And it's funny, I've got all girls. My three girls, 17, 11, and 6. My 11-year-old comes out, I've got the old school Doom game for PlayStation. And last year I played it a little bit. And this year she actually came out and she said, Dad, I want to, hey, can we play some Doom together, right? It's like a son asking to play catch or whatever, so it was very cool. that, you know, sit down with my kid and play some video games, you know, that I put everything else on hold, man. As soon as she said, you know, let's play some video games together, let's hang out and everything else, well, everything else got deprioritized, and that was the most important thing going. It was a big deal. And then she looked at this this drawing, which kind of, you know, kind of sparked me getting it finished. You know, she looked at this drawing, and she's like, she said that it wasn't even finished yet and was insanely amazing. So, you know, the double whammy that night kind of made my whole summer. So, very cool.
Right on.
Now, we had talked about some technical issues that we were having last weekend with the echo, and right before the show started, I kind of heard the echo, but I don't see anybody here complaining about the echo now, and I'm not hearing it at all. So hopefully that's not going to be an issue throughout the show.
Right. So, let me actually ask, is what I'm typing in showing up in the chat room?
I don't see you logged in at all in the chat room, unless you're one of the guests. Looks like Silver Dime, Sarah Duffy are the only ones that have actually commented in the chat room.
This happened last week, and I ended up having to do a little bit of wiggling around. Not last week, actually, but yesterday. I ended up having to do a little bit of wiggling around, and then I got it working correctly. And on the studio, I mean, the studio is kind of cool in that you actually have the chat now on the exact same page as the switchboard in a mini version. And actually, now I'm looking, and I can see you now that I've done a little bit of fooling. You should be able to see me logged in now.
Yeah, you just showed up.
Yeah.
Right on.
So, just, you know, word of the wise, in case I'm not here or whatever, and you try to open it up in this studio, you've got to actually pop it out into the full-blown chat room first, and then close that out and come back, and you can use the little mini chat that they have right there and keep it all on the same page.
Right on. And we may not be the most professional outfit, but it's getting a little bit more professional every time we do the show.
Yeah.
And this new studio thing is just mind blowing. How cool it is, and how involved that can be. So kind of digging that. But anyways, let's go ahead and I guess get into the topic. Tonight we're going to be talking about Atlas Shrugged. This is a novel by Ayn Rand. And this is basically what we wanted to talk about. I mean, most people here are familiar with the novel. We'll get into that a little bit about what, you know, what the novel says and what have you. But what we wanted to talk about is how the things that Rand was talking about in this book, and this was her, you know, big deal. This was her major masterpiece, Atlas Shrugged, that really encompassed her philosophy that she went on later to write about. She called it objectivism. So Atlas Shrugged was a work of fiction that kind of developed and presented this, her philosophy, and what she thought was going to go down as far as the direction we were going, even back when she wrote this book, as a society here in the U.S.
Right.
Now, Rand was herself a Russian immigrant, and just a really interesting mind, a really different way of thinking, a very progressive way of thinking. And for those Satanists who are listening tonight, well, then they're familiar with some of Rand's philosophy, because Anton LaVey, who wrote the Satanic Bible, also, you know, was into Rand and picked up on some of what Rand considered objectivism, although he didn't fully embrace it. He had his own little version of it, basically, but it was an influence on his own work and his own efforts.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just actually, first I wanted to say it's been a really long time since I've read this book, so if I seem a little bit out of the loop for a second, or I'm having trouble trying to remember it, this is why. I think the last time that I actually went through this book, I was 19 years old, so.
Right on. Well, it's become a big deal recently because the first half of the two-part movie has been out, and it's part of the it's a political issue, because the players in the political scene, especially on the conservative end of the spectrum, have kind of picked up on Atlas Shrugged as, again, a statement about what they see going on today, and some of the ideas that need to be embraced in order to deal with what we see going on as a society. So I haven't seen the film myself. I probably won't even bother going to see the film because, you know, I prefer the book. But still, it's out there and it's back basically, and it's taking on a new life, if you will. Ayn Rand herself was very was atheist, so it's kind of interesting to hear these, you know, these Christian rights folks, these very right wing politicians embrace this very atheistic philosophy. But again, we're going to be talking about the different parallels between this book and some of the stuff we see going on in our society today.
Right. Well, I think in my mind, it only makes sense that maybe since you sort of touched on it at some point, and I'm not saying it has to be dealt with immediately, but at some point in this show, maybe you could just sort of spell out what you see as being the difference between Ayn Rand's objectivism and Anton LaVey's objectivism. It would be really interesting in that aspect, I think, mainly because you're such a concise thinker. So if we could at some point touch on that, that'd be awesome.
Well, I think I guess I can get into it right now. Rand's objectivism doesn't bother with any symbolism, doesn't bother with any half measures, basically. It's fully is what it is. Whereas LaVey, I'm not saying LaVey has a different sort of objectivism, but more that he didn't embrace everything that Rand's objectivism embraces. LaVey has, Satanism is a distinct philosophy. It borrows from a lot of things. It takes from a lot of places. It has parallels with many things, but it is what it is. Satanism is different from objectivism. I think Rand would have considered LaVey kind of a kook, to be perfectly honest. But where they parallel is that Rand was very much about a person doing for themselves, that everyone should take care of themselves. And then, if everybody's taking care of themselves, then there'd be nobody left to take care of. People should be able to do what they want. They should be able to indulge in what they want to indulge in, whether it was talking about economics or politics or morality. The character, the main character in the book, Dagny Taggart, expresses this. I wouldn't say amoral sexual attitude, but more of a laissez-faire sexual attitude that. She considers sex the highest form of human expression, which means that you didn't engage in sex for reproduction purposes necessarily. You didn't have a traditional moral obligation when engaged in sex. It was for rational and celebratory purposes, basically. And LaVey, I think, embraced a lot of those ideas in his Satanism. But then I would say that some of the window dressing that LaVey added to, what would be considered objectivism to make Satanism, Rand would have seen as frivolous and unnecessary.
Right. Well, I think Ayn Rand's mind was very, what's the word that I want to, minimalistic. I think that Occam's Razor was definitely in full swing.
Right, right. Yeah, the Rand was, basically, as little bullshit as possible. Just trying to cut to the chase. And for those people who haven't read the book, the thing that I find the most encompasses this philosophy, these ideas, is the oath that the characters basically swear to themselves. They live by this oath when they engage in this new society that the Galt people were actually establishing. The oath is, I swear by my life and my love of that. Okay, I swear by my life and the love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine. And that pretty much encompasses the whole of the philosophy, is that you do for yourself, you see to your own needs, you take care of yourself, and then if you have excess with which to trade, whether it's anything. If it's economic or if it's, social, whatever, if you have excess with which to trade, then you trade that excess to others. Now, you're ultimately responsible for yourself. And in trading that excess, You may, let's say, and this is another part of, I guess, the LaVey philosophy that's originated with Rand. You might go out and actually give things of yourself to people, gifts, let's say, charity or what have you, but you're doing it fully aware that you're doing it for your own pleasure. You're doing it for your own sense of well-being, that you're doing it for your enjoyment. I remember a story, I think it was Boyd Rice talking about this, that the Black House in San Francisco was badly in need of some exterior paint, that it hadn't been painted for in a while, and LaVey was, you know, getting up in years. And when Mr. Rice said to LaVey, hey, I want to paint your house for you, you know, just go ahead and put another coat of paint on it, Anton LaVey was saying, no, you don't. I don't need you to do that. If I need to take care of it, I'll take care of it myself. And Rice had to insist that, no, I want to do it for you for my pleasure. I'm not doing this as a charitable act. I'm not doing this as any sense of obligation to you. I just don't like the way the house looks, and I want to take care of it for myself. So the house ends up getting taken care of as far as the coat of paint.
Right on. Right on. But see, and this is kind of, I know I'm taking this on a serious tip, but it's kind of in my mind the idea that it has to be some form of a charitable act, because and what I see is Boyd Rice having looking and seeing something that ultimately will need fixed one way or the other in the future, and realizing that, you know, hey, I use this facility myself too. You know, I kind of think that it goes deeper than just, you know, I want to do this for my own pleasure. It's beyond his own pleasure. It's actually enhancing something that he uses on a regular basis. It's like, you know, you and your friends all use this, I don't know, clubhouse that you rent out once a month. And so when you're in there, you know, if it's got a 52-inch TV and, you know, you guys all have the extra funds to do so, dropping a 60-inch or a wall projector on there, you know, it's not really so much a charitable act as it is enhancing the environment that you're in. It's, in my opinion, the ultimate saturation of, your sphere. I've always been a firm believer that people have a certain sphere in which they exist in, that the skin's end on your body is not the end of your actual being.
Well, definitely. And I agree with those sentiments, you know, entirely, that, you know, whether it's charitable, it's not necessarily a charitable act. I don't necessarily believe in altruism, that you do something for your own well-being. You do something because you enjoy it. You do something because it brings you pleasure. Or, as you're saying, that you're going to benefit from it, or it's a reflection of yourself, that you are associated with, like you're saying, that clubhouse. You're associated with this institution, associated with this nation, this society, or whatever. So you do something so that association is reflective of you and doesn't reflect a negative light upon you. That, you know, the neighborhood's not trashy, you know, that I live in, partially because I don't want to be considered trashy myself. I want the neighborhood to reflect who I am. So absolutely. I think that's what something that Rand is saying with this book is that given the opportunity to voluntarily do what we will not only take care of ourselves, but we'll take care of those things around us just out of our, you know, general urge to, you know, feel good about who we are and see that reflected in our environment, that larger sphere of self that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I think that the environment in which you grow in, and this is one of the things that makes the fact that humans are social creatures an interesting dynamic, in that if you have an overlapping environment that you share with somebody and you both are working together to enhance it, you oftentimes can build something really solid and wonderful in a very short period of time. But when you share that space with a person who is not trying to enhance it, but rather just draws from that, obviously then it always ends in some form of a disastrous effect. So I think inherently it should be natural default that we want to enrich, you know, that larger sphere that I've been talking about.
But and that's some of the things that I wanted to get into on tonight's discussion, is that there's a tendency that we're seeing in society, and it's something that I'm just observing or what have you. It's something that's actually being written about and being discussed by sociologists, politicians, and what have you, people that watch trends. That we're in a position as a society where we celebrate mediocrity. We celebrate apathy, not doing, not trying to be exemplary, not trying to make the most of whatever it is you're going to do, even for your own benefit. That we tend to reward the mediocre. We reward those folks that do less do less than they need to, so they can be taken care of. And those people that excel, we tend to punish in our society anymore. And this is something that Rand warned about in her book. And this is, where this was going. That, and she talked about an interview in Playboy, and I don't know what year it was, 1964 or something like that. She embraces the idea of capitalism, but she sees what we have in our society as not a true capitalism. That there are some freedoms and there are some controls. And as the shift moves from freedom to control, where there's further and further regulation, eventually you establish a dictatorship, whether by system or by a group of people or by government or what have you. We're ruled more than we are able to do what we want to do. And when that happens, that's when you'll have the things like an Atlas Shrugged that occur, when people actually go on strike or revolt. We're not at that point yet, but you see with increasing unemployment, you see with more and more people choosing to be a drain on resources, to be what Rand would either consider a parasite or a looter, or I'm sorry, a parasite or a moocher. And I can get to those definitions here. There are three of them, the looter, the moocher, and the parasite. When it becomes more socially acceptable to be on the dole, to be on welfare, than it is to have a job. I actually heard some trans talking one day about how only suckers actually work. There's more to be gotten from the system than there is from a hard day's employment. When that shift happens, though, that's when the shit hits the fan, basically.
Right on. Well, the first thing that kind of pops into my mind is the notion that why should we be concerned with, whether or not someone is actually putting in a hard day's work. And I'm taking this from kind of an opposite stance, just for the value of entertaining the idea. I mean, I myself, obviously, I feel there's something to contribute, and not necessarily on the level of the system, but on the undercurrent side of it. But why is it important to put in a hard day's work versus just, getting everything that you can get with as little effort as possible?
Well, I would say that, first of all, I totally understand that point, and that's why our society, I think, is trending in that direction, is because more and more people are realizing that they can get more being on the dole than they can doing whatever they need to do for themselves. The issue is that the resources that they're drawing from are finite, that there's only so much to go around. And in exchange for what it is they're getting, those resources, that finite pool of resources they're drawing from, in exchange for that, they're giving up certain liberties. And those liberties will become more and more restrictive as those resources become restrictive. It'll be harder and harder to draw from that pool. So, like right now, there's a certain restriction on who can draw from that pool. And they're talking about saying that if you're going to draw from that pool, well, then we're going to drug test you. So if you're somebody that occasionally imbibes in some recreational drugs, well, they're going to drug test you to limit that pool, that drain on those resources. Down the road, they might go even further. They might say, if you've got X number of children, we're going to start cutting off your funds because you got too many kids. Or if you're under a certain age limit or over a certain age limit or whatever, we're going to cut you out because they need to preserve that resource pool. They need to keep it available so that people want to be on the dole. But that's the one thing that I see going on, is that the reason to do something for yourself rather than just be a drain on those resources is because the pool's limited and you're giving up your freedoms. The other thing I think is going on is not so much that it's wrong to be on the dole, that it's wrong to do those things. The issue for me is responsibility. That when you turn over responsibility to somebody else, you're setting yourself up for failure, setting yourself up for a fall. That what freedoms you enjoy now, you may not enjoy. And I know I kind of touched on that. That any decision you make, you should be free to make that decision as long as you're able to pay for the consequences, as long as you're able to handle whatever comes down the line based on that decision. I think in Sin, they were talking about abortion, and that was one of the points that came to my mind with that argument, was that there's nothing wrong with a woman using an abortion as a means of birth control. It's just that she has to be willing to suffer those consequences. She has to be willing to, if the surgery is botched, well, then she has to be willing to pay for that surgery, the correction for that medical issue on her own as well. At no point should a person have to lean on the system or society to take care of themselves, to take care of their needs.
Right.
And the other thing is, I guess, while they're voluntarily, being in the system and engaging that system, we are all mandatorily providing for their needs. If somebody didn't have a gun to my head saying, we're taking your taxes, or you're going to pay your taxes, or we're going to come in and we're going to take away your stuff, whatever, you're going to go to jail for not paying into the system, well, I would probably have more funds available to me to do what I want, to stimulate the economy, to engage in whatever social activities I want, to keep more people at work. But the other thing is that I wouldn't resent it as much. I wouldn't be as opposed to the idea of then handing out money for my pleasure.
Right. What's actually really interesting to me about this whole thing is that if people did actually take that effort and step away from the mentality that they, should just be able to snag whatever they want and it should be as easy as possible, if they were more productive, there would be more demand happening. I don't know how else to explain this other than what they've done is remove themselves from a cycle, a wheel, and just whenever they were hungry, reached their hand over and taken whatever's fallen in one particular stage in the cycle. Where if they could manage to actually go out and put an effort, real effort into getting a job, and then when they obtain one, put an even more effort into actually performing well, it would ultimately lead to more efficiency, which would lead to, I could think of a lot of things that would lead to, but more specifically, it would just kind of create this supply and demand flux, because you now have something that's streamlined, that's not so difficult to deal with, and it might then become more convenient for people to get to. And it's interesting because what you'd be doing is trading one form or one sense of ease for another. You trade the sense of ease of not having to actually, go out and get these things with some sort of integrity or merit, but now you have the ease of gaining whatever benefits are associated with the integrity that you've gained by actually putting in a hard day's work. The old expression that I'm familiar with goes, it's easier to get a job when you have a job than it is when you don't. That kind of thing speaks in volumes when it talks about the fact that people look, they want somebody who can come in and immediately do whatever it is that they do, and then they show that they have the initiative to make the process of getting them to a productive stage efficient. That's an attractive appeal, and it makes it, something that you're more considerate of.
And what I think is, what you're saying basically is, and what I think is expressed in Rand's book, is that being on the dole, being engaged in that system, taking whatever welfare, whatever handouts you qualify for, whatever, that gets you a little bit of security. That gets you a little bit of freedom because you don't have to go to work. You don't have to do anything for it. The thing that people tend to miss or that they're neglectful of is their responsibility or lack thereof. If you're being given something, if you're being given freedom, if you're being given security, if you're being given people, then those things can be taken away as well. So versus if you go out and get those things, if you go out and take those things, if you make those things for yourself, it's harder to take those things away from you. So, and responsibility is the issue. I don't have an issue with anybody being on the dole, being on welfare. I would say, I would almost encourage anybody that qualifies to be on any type of government program to go get on it. Because the faster that system is overburdened, the faster that that system, that resource, that limited pool of resource I was talking about is drained, then the faster it goes away. Then the faster that all this bullshit, all the bureaucracy, all the crap that we see in our government, all the nonsensical altruism and non-absolutes as far as the way we deal with each other, putting a PC bullshit, I mean, it all gets wiped out when the funds get wiped out. So get what you can while you can get it. Just also be responsible. Be responsible to yourself. I can only look to my own needs. So that's what I tend to do, is look to my own and take care of myself. If the shit hits the fan tomorrow, I'm covered. I'm good to go. And I won't be worried about anybody else other than you trying to take what I've got, which is, you know, why you get the hell out of the city, basically. But if you're out there on the dole and thinking this is going to go on forever, thinking that this is going to be, you know, this is always going to be available to you and should always be available to you, like you're entitled to it, or this is the role of government to provide for your basic needs instead of you providing for them, well, again, you're setting yourself up for failure. You're setting yourself up for that one day when the government decides, hey, you know what? You're expendable. You have more value as Soylent Green than you do as a human being walking around breathing air.
Right on. And it needs to get to that point. It's funny because I've been on this real kick lately about poisoning the system. And as I was sitting here listening to you talk, it came into my mind that too much of any one thing is toxic to a body. You know, if you get too much oxygen or pure oxygen, it's toxic. Too much carbon monoxide, it's too much. Too much milk, you know, too much this, that, it's toxic to the body. So that's definitely a good point. If there's a system that you feel exonerates certain traits that you find repugnant, the best thing in the world that you could probably do is overburden that.
Right, right. And it's this argument that I guess we've been seeing in different circles and everything else about, you know, fighting against the system or supporting the system, whatever. And my mind's like, you know, why not do both? Why not, you know, take advantage of every advantage you can get from that system, and in the meantime, you know, make sure that you've got everything you need so that when that system collapses, you're still in a position to take care of yourself. You still are responsible to yourself.
Right.
Unfortunately, right now, we see a system where the majority of society is encouraged to be irresponsible. There's this encouragement to not be concerned about yourself because, you know, the government, you know, mama government will always be around to take care of you.
Right on.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, it's just interesting because that is like, I don't know, in my mind, just maybe the same philosophy that I practice in Satanism could be practiced on that level as well in a different understanding, you know, defiant of an external being, defiant of any kind of need for an external intervention.
Right on. Right. Yeah, because when you rely on that external force, you're exactly right. We can talk about religion. When you rely on that external God to provide for your needs, well, that means you are a slave to that God. You're a slave to whatever that is that's taking care of you. I've always found it kind of ironic that the civil rights movements of the 60s and 70s or whatever, where people were, you know, demanding that the government give them certain freedoms, so the government give them certain allocations, that they didn't recognize that it's just a different type of shackle they're putting around their neck. Instead of just taking those freedoms for themselves, instead of just doing those things themselves, they're demanding it from an outside source.
Right. Right, and then because the outside source has to cater to the will of more than one, you come up with a cookie cutter recipe for how to perpetuate this freedom, so to speak. So, in other words, you know, if you had just taken this liberty yourself, you would probably get more out of a liberty and not have to deal with the red tape. You know, if I want to build a shed in my backyard, if I just build it myself, you know, the worst thing I might have to deal with is a couple of fines later down the road if they catch me. But 9 times out of 10, if they didn't see you build it, they can't prove how old it is. It's very possible that it was, you know, it's very possible that it was built a long time ago and has been upkept. You know, you don't have to worry about whether or not you've got, you know, X hurricane hinges or the wood's rated to this pressure or the side panels meet this code or whatever it is. You know, you don't have those rules and restrictions if you just go ahead and do it.
Right, that's that kind of leads me into my next point here, and it kind of going in the opposite direction of what you're saying, is if you just go out and make it for yourself, you don't have that bureaucracy that you have to deal with. But what we're seeing in our society today is something that, again, that Rand talked about in her book, is that level bureaucracy is increasing, that a bureaucracy basically are the layers of systems and bullshit between you and the things you need. That the further that you can be pushed from your resources, from the things that you need to survive. And we're talking about, I mean, just the basic conditions of being a human being, you know, food, water, all that. The more systems, the more hoops you have to jump through to get those things that you need, well, then the less and less control you have, the less and less freedom you actually, you know, enjoy. I thought it was interesting that when I was reading something by a guy who lived in the Middle East, basically, in a third world country, you know, it was a discussion about freedoms, and he was basically telling somebody, hey, don't talk to me about freedoms and everything else. Most of you people can't own a goat in your home. And, you know, he's absolutely right. You know, an animal like that is a food source that you've got it. You don't have to go out and buy more milk. You don't have to go out and buy the cheese. You've got the goat. But most of us live in situations where having that kind of animal in our homes would be impossible. We'd be kicked out. We wouldn't be able to live in the places we live. And it's an issue with these bureaucracies. It's another form of control. The more layers between you and your basic needs, the less freedom you have.
Agreed. Absolutely. And it's a tighter fit for sure. I mean, if we really wanted to use an analogy, we could say it's the difference between having a Trojan and then having a Magnum and then possibly being able to fill it versus having a lifestyle and it being a little too snug.
Right on. And it's exactly. It's, you know, you find yourself in a situation where the things you enjoy when they're taken away, and or there's greater and greater demands placed on you to get those things. It becomes problematic. And that's where we see ourselves in society today. Another parallel in the book was the subsidization of irrational products or ideas or systems, that the government's willing to subsidize certain programs or certain products because they think it's politically expedient or it's morally expedient. And a couple of things that come to mind right now, right off the top of my head, are ethanol, and these fluorescent bulbs that everybody is required to, or is going to be required to get, that the standard bulbs, the incandescent bulbs that we normally enjoy, but here in Texas, they're actually passing legislation saying that we won't follow those federal regulations. We'll just have to buy bulbs that are made here in Texas. But again, it's a matter of, you know, if the fluorescent bulbs are better than the incandescent bulbs, well, let the fluorescent bulbs prove that in the open market. Let the people decide that the regular bulbs we're used to are obsolete and inadequate for their needs, that they're not cost effective. If the people decide that, the market will bill out. The market will make those determinations. The same with ethanol. You know, it takes more energy to produce the ethanol than the actual ethanol puts out. It's not cost effective, and now we're in a situation where it actually might create some sort of food shortage or cause food prices to go up. because of the ethanol subsidies being given out by the government, the amount of corn being, you know, earmarked for ethanol. And it's all kinds of programs like that. You know, there's certain anti-addiction programs. There's all kinds of, different, women's health care as far as making decisions about, birth control and things like that, that, you know, it's probably not necessary. It's probably not something the government should be invested in, but because it's politically expedient or because it meets some sort of moral code, we do it anyway. We don't look at the cost, benefit to risk ratio. Whereas if the free market were to rule out, well then things would end up being a lot less expensive than they are now.
Right on. And the system's fucked up. That's all I can say.
Right. And it's getting worse.
Yeah.
The one thing that's not happening, or at least that I don't see happening in our society that Rand talked about, was the John Galt movement, was the brain drain from our markets and from our industries and everything else. And what this basically means is that in the book, what was going on is we were in that dictatorship where the government, the system, the bureaucracy controlled more of what was going on than the freedoms anybody would enjoy. So the people that were the innovators, the inventors, the people that wanted to do for themselves, they began to abandon society. They turn their back on the industries. They leave their jobs. They go away, basically. A lot of them would just, what they did is they stopped doing, whatever it was they would do. Like if you were some sort of engineer working on computer systems or whatever, and you were working on new innovations for the computer industry, and realized that you weren't going to get the benefit from your own work because of the expense of the bureaucracy and what have you, well, you just walked out on your job. You'd rather go out and get a job as a janitor, go out and get a job picking, tomatoes or whatever. Flipping burgers was an example in this in the book. There was a philosophy teacher, a professor, who was heralded as one of the most groundbreaking philosophers of his time. They find him in a diner flipping burgers, and he preferred to flip a burger than give any more support or sustenance to the system. So, it's going to take that kind of dictatorship to push us in that direction. But I think, especially with a lot of the talk we've seen on, Sin and other places, Satanic International Network and other places, that there's beginning to be this groundswell, this interest in the idea that maybe we should start thinking about what would it take to turn our backs on the things that are going on around us.
Yeah. It's actually very interesting because there's seems to be a common thread that is underlying in the circles that we run in, and that there's all this recognition of an oppressive system. And I think it's something that has always been there. It's just now people are really looking at it and really shaking their finger at it. And ultimately, what I am noticing could be nothing more than an occurrence that happens in some kind of reoccurring fashion. But it does seem like the idea of that philosophical prism is maybe not so far off of what we all view as being the truth.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's something that we created for ourselves, the bureaucracy, the morality, the whatever, the traditions, the obligations, all of that. We created those restrictions ourselves, generations upon generation we create these things. And then we do it to ourselves in our own minds, that we feel that we have to meet those obligations. We feel that we have to obey those certain moral codes. We feel that we have to, fit the traditional mold. I mean, I'm thinking about just being a kid. I mean, you spend 12 years or 13 years in school being trained on how to be a functional member of society as a drone, basically, as part of the workforce. And you get, you're 18 years old. Well, what's the ideal? Well, now I move out of my house. I go to college. And when I get out of college, I go buy my own house. get a car or two, get married, get kids. Why is that the one route to happiness? Why is that the one route to success? Especially with children. You know, love my children to death and everything else, but you can't, if you have kids, there's a whole set of social obligations that are placed upon you. Like, for instance, sending your children to school, to some sort of state-authorized school system, so that they can be programmed to be good little citizens of the state. How the hell is that necessary, especially with the level of education that most average people have? Most people know how to read, they know how to write, they know mathematics, they know what to do. You know, if their kid shows a certain aptitude for something, well, then the parents can step up and go ahead and make sure that kid is engaged in whatever it is they're able to do. And then when the kid goes out to get a job, they go out and get a job based on their own merits, not on the particular institution they graduated from. So, yeah, it's these systems of control that it's really all in our heads. It's a prison that we've created for ourselves, a prison of the mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I oftentimes try to sit back and imagine what it would be like if everybody in the world just stopped any kind of free market or free trade. If they just said, you know what, from this day forward, all I'm going to do is what I love. It's all I'm going to do. If today I love, you know, planting seeds in the garden, I'll plant seeds in the garden. Tomorrow, if I love fixing cars, I'll fix cars. What would happen? I mean, in some senses, I want to say that it's potential a global collapse, a societal collapse. And the other aspect, I think that we might come to realize that just by being able to do what we love at all times and do what we were in the mood to do at that moment, maybe some kind of natural ecosystem would occur. And, you know, quite possibly, you know, hey, Johnny over there, he built 15 motorcycles yesterday, and you need transportation to get over here because you're delivering letters because that's what you love doing. You know, and so it would work itself out. Everybody gets their mail. You've got a motorcycle. Johnny, he got his mail too because now you can bring it to him. You know, it almost seems unnecessary to trade this symbolic piece of paper God that we trade constantly.
Right. I totally agree with that. That the if people were to wake up tomorrow, and it's not, I don't even think it's a matter of necessarily doing what you love, although ultimately that's what it would lead to. It would just be, you know, being willing, first of all, to take those risks. Being responsible for yourself is a huge risk, you know, compared to, you know, having the government take care of you, having your parents take care of you, having the people around you take care of you. Doing your own thing and taking that risk is huge. Taking responsibility for the consequences of your choices would be huge. Where, you know, if everybody tomorrow were to go, you know what, I'm no longer going to place my freedoms, my security, my whatever, in somebody else's hand, that would be huge. And then I don't see it as being the end of civilization. You mentioned earlier something about this being a cyclical kind of event, that this kind of thing happens. And what I see going on is, you know, studying history, it seems, that as these cycles occur, they grow in strength, basically. The wave comes crashing down harder and harder and harder each time it comes crashing down. And we're seeing what we're seeing now in our society is that there's little waves going on. There's little cycles going on that are growing in strength. And our system has been desperately trying to perpetuate sort of stasis in a place where stasis doesn't exist. So when the things do come crashing down, the backlash is going to be significant. And it is going to be something like you're talking about. It's not going to be the end of civilization, but it's going to be a radical shift in how we define civilization. And then maybe, you know, again, we'll trade a little bit more honestly. We won't use these, you know, these paper gods, basically, these dollar bills, as a measure of value, but rather value would be what a man can produce and his word.
Right. I mean, it would be the actual quality of what's being produced, along with the amount that you could actually put out there, that would give you that natural stratification.
Right, right. And it would be, you know, you earn based on your own merit, based on your own ability. So, and that's why I think is lacking in today's society. And that's the thing that I think Rand is pointing out as being one of our major issues, is that merit is meaningless anymore. You're better off being mediocre than having any merit. You're better off having some sort of social acceptability rather than an actual value system that is as meaningful, that's rational, and it's worth a damn, basically.
Right on. Oh, man. Wow. I mean, I guess I could go on and on and on. This actually kind of hits real close to home for me, in that my whole focus is how to get myself out of this fucked up loop, you know, this mirage that I'm forced to participate in a daily basis with. And it's bad enough now that, well, I have a kid and I still have the same goal, but not only do I have to now be able to escape this thing, but I've got to figure out how to drag him through it with me, you know.
Right.
I look at all of this pandering to weakness, and especially exaggerated weakness. That really pisses me off. You know, people who play the victim because it's the easiest way to, you know, get that extra help, get that extra pat on the back, you know, whatever it is you're going after. It's always easiest to whine and say you've been done, that something has been, you know, wronging you. And, you know, from there, people generally tend to overcompensate because they just want you to shut the fuck up. A good example of this, and I really, you know, I don't mean this to in a racist sense, but there's a certain population within the Black community that has this mentality that because their ancestors were repressed and their, you know, current ancestors are repressed, or, you know, I don't mean current ancestors, but what I mean is the more current ancestors were repressed in one way or the other, that they're somehow owed something just simply by bloodline.
Right. Well, the entitlement mentality, and it's not just one particular, you know, ethnic group, although, you know, the more historic your excuse, the better. But it's, you know, it's any group. You know, I was born poor, so I deserve something. I was born, you know, fair skin, so I deserve something, or because, you know, the sun is bad for me or whatever. Or I was born in a, you know, in a who knows, you know, anything. Instead of taking responsibility for yourself, I mean, it all falls back on taking responsibility for yourself. And an interesting thing about the idea of victim mentality that Rand brings up in Atlas Shrugged is she doesn't see victim mentality as being just those people that think they're entitled to something because they are the victim of the society, the victim of the system. They consider those people parasites. But the other end of the victim mentality are those people that think that they have to go out and earn for others, that they have some sort of obligation to others just because they have the ability to earn, that they're smarter than their peers or stronger than their peers, that they're pressured by society to do for others. That sort of victim mentality is the mentality that Rand says really needs to be defeated. That convincing the people, the able-bodied people, that they don't have to support the system. They don't have to buy into that idea that they have some sort of obligation to others. That it's up to them to be responsible for themselves and make choices about what obligations they actually want to fulfill.
Right on. Well, I mean, like I said, Ayn Rand has to be one of the sharpest minds that I've ever read. That the level of philosophical fat cutting. It's just amazing. You know, when you really stop and you vector things in a sense that they really are out there, you can only really come to these conclusions that most of this stuff is, if not dead on right, as close to right as you can get to. So.
Right. I mean, there's issues with the philosophy, obviously. There's issues where, you know, there's a certain cold-bloodedness to it that most people don't want to stomach. You know, when you deal with people who are truly needy, when you deal with people who truly are unable to take care of themselves, objectivism has some failings. But overall, I mean, even in situations like that, if there was a return to the family unit, a return to your clan, basically, the people that you deal with in your family, that you're related to by blood, that their resources are pooled based on, you know, being part of that group. And, of course, everybody in the family recognizes that they have a role to play and they have certain, you know, they have a certain thing that they need to fulfill, that there's an honor in making sure that your family's taken care of. Then when you have somebody that's infirmed, or you have somebody that with a disability or something like that, where the family actually steps up and took care of those people. I mean, this is how our country existed for, I mean, you can argue that the first 150 or 100 years of the country's existence was based on these same ideas, these same principles. And then somewhere along the way, somebody got it in their head that it'd be a good idea if the common good, which used to just mean the infrastructure and the military and what have you, if the common good meant something more, like, you know, taking care of the poor, taking care of the people who are unwilling to take care of themselves, that kind of thing, that's when things got a little bit twisted, and that's how we find ourselves on this slippery slope that we're going down right now.
Right on. I mean, I could actually probably point to a few parallels within the Lucifer principle that I can think of, but... sadly, we're running really short on time, so I'll just kind of point that out there and see if anybody wants to, I don't know, get the extra credit points. Three minutes left. This is usually our time to, you know, plug whatever. I wanted to take some time to acknowledge that Lehi actually, he graced us with his presence and has been participating heavily in the chat room.
Yeah, if you're going to be there here for Jen's tattoo tomorrow night too, man, let me know. It's cool if you show up and everything. It's just actually probably make me a little bit more comfortable about the whole situation. So Lehi, if you're going to be here tomorrow night, just let me know, man. Send me a text message or something. Say something in the chat room. My internet went away for some reason, so I'm trying to figure out what's going on.
Oh, that's fine, man. I mean, we really literally got 2 minutes left, and I don't really see much coming in the way of commentary yet. But, you know, there's usually a 10-20 second lag. Well, I mean, if Lehi does show up, man, that's cool. You'd be hanging out with a semi-celebrity already.
Yeah, there you go. I would ask people to check out the Creative Audio Studios blog. It's where I've been posting some artwork, talking about the actual process and everything that's going on with the art. It's creativeaudiostudios.blogspot.com. Or if you just go to the Creative Audio Studios website and click on blog, they're on pretty much the top of every page. You'll go to the Creative Audio Studios website. You'll see the new artwork, the new zombie girl drawing, and you can leave your comments. Subscribe to the blog, and when I post other stuff, you can check it out there. And it's a good way for me to put down my thoughts as to what I'm thinking when I'm doing the artwork or what processes I go through. So if you're curious about that kind of minutia, check out that blog. You might dig it.
Rock on. Anything else?
That's all I got, man.
All right, rock on. Talk to you all next week.
All right, man, later.
Thank you for listening to The Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily represent the opinions held by CC, Zach, Jason, Matt, or any other institution represented by them. If you have been offended by the production of this show, we are sorry, but this is the old expression goes. Tough luck. Special thanks to Dad Rocky DeRoma for his contribution to this outro. The Ooze is a Creative Oddity Studios product and is presented by Titanic International Network as its official Blog Talk radio show. Why waste your time with those other guys?